All right, we started figurative language last week. We talked about literal and figurative language, and we talked about the purposes, just like we have purposes for using figurative language. You know, like I've told you a million times not to exaggerate, you know, those type of figures of speech that we use. We use them for a lot of reasons. We talked about some to make things stand out, you know, to make them more vivid, to make something, to make it where people could remember it better, to illustrate it, to explain things. And so we talked about some of those instances. We did some examples. We talked about some of the rules to apply when we're using figurative language. Talking about things like never use it figuratively when it contradicts something that's plain. And we talked about how that was the one that was probably the most misused, because a lot of times a very figurative verse or text is used to try and explain some literal text that's very easy to understand. And they do it just backwards. And I don't know how many times I've read just in the past month about Revelation 20 should be taken literally, pretty much the whole chapter. And it is so ridiculous to take Revelation chapter 20 literally, it is just beyond belief. But if you do that, then you have to go back to all the other passages that are easy to understand and reinterpret all of those passages, every one of them. So that's the danger of not harmonizing the more difficult text with the easier text that's understandable. You know, if Revelation 20 weren't in the Bible, most of these ideas that we have about the end times would never have been considered. But because there's about six verses that talk about a millennial reign and some things like that, then those five or six verses have affected the entire rest of the Bible, going all the way back to some passages in Daniel, some passages in Ezekiel. And so if you look at the rest of the New Testament, there's no hint that there's going to be separate resurrections for the righteous and unrighteous. There's never a hint that there's going to be signs of, there's no hint that there's some sort of Armageddon coming. There's no hint of any of those things. But when you take Revelation chapter 20 literally, then you have to reinterpret all of those other places in the Old and New Testament. So that's the danger to figurative language. You always interpret the difficult things in light of the easier things. We do that in everyday life. So that was one thing that always has to be done. Then we started talking about, or started to look at some of the different types of figures of speech. And that's kind of where we are tonight, the types of figures of speech. And I said if you looked at Bullinger's, his is considered the standard work on biblical figures of speech. There's over 200 of them. We're not going to look at over 200 of them. I've got about 16. I thought that'd be enough, but maybe 20. But we're going to look at some of the ones that we know maybe from school a little more obviously, and then look at some of the rarer ones. So we're going to start, and we're going to look at several examples of these. We're going to look at simile first. And is that on the handout that I gave you last time somewhere? It should be, I think, somewhere. What does it say on the handout a simile is? Because I've got a different handout in front of me.
Said to be like or as something of a different kind.
Okay. Uses the words as or like to compare things, okay, to compare things, usually of a different type, okay? Well, let's start looking at some of these then, and we'll try and glean what we can from them. Let's first of all go to 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 2. No, I think that's 1 Peter 1:24. Should be a 24. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 24. Someone read that, please. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 24. Okay, there's our word that we're looking for, as, and he's comparing flesh, in other words, humanity, our humanism, to grass. Now, those two things aren't normally associated with one another, are they? So, in other words, he's comparing or using one thing to describe something else, using that word as, that you normally wouldn't consider being similar. Well, what is he teaching there? Why does he use grass? Why doesn't he say all flesh is as a rock?
Temporary.
Okay. Rocks, you think about being here, you know, practically forever. But grass, you know, comes up, grows, and is gone. It's not here very long. So when he uses that simile, he's stressing how transient, how temporary, how short-lived our fleshly body is. All right? Let's go to Matthew 23. These are the words of Jesus to the Pharisees. Because in each of these, I hope we can see why he chose the ones that he did choose. Matthew 23, verse 27. Matthew 23, verse 27, if you'd like to read that.
Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye are like unto whitened sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness.
Okay, see how he takes two things that you wouldn't normally compare? People to a whitewashed tomb. Well, why does he use a whitewashed tomb? Why does he say they're like these whitewashed tombs? What was he trying to stress to the Pharisees to get them to understand about what they were doing? That's right. Look good on the outside, evil on the inside. And, you know, in Matthew 23, that's what he calls them hypocrites several times, right? And that's kind of what a hypocrite is. Appears to be something outwardly that they're not at all like inwardly. So the Pharisees were... Yes, go ahead.
The Navajo, and my wife's Navajo, that's where I learned this, but well, not from her, but from being around Navajo. They have a term called Biligani Bilisani. And Biligani is a white person. Biligani Bilisani, I'm sorry, is an apple. So what they're saying is, you look red on the outside, but you're white on the inside.
Oh, that's good, yeah. All right. That's a good figure of speech. Very similar to this right here. Very similar to it. That's what he's wanting to stress. And, you know, he talks about in Matthew 23 how these Pharisees, you know, they dressed a certain way and spoke a certain way and wanted people to see them do certain religious things. But inwardly, they were just completely rotten. They weren't a bit sincere. All they were wanting was the praise of men. So he uses that expression. All right. Some others I think we'll be familiar with. I know these you will be. Ephesians chapter 5. Look at verse 25. It says, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Now he's making kind of a sort of a double comparison, isn't he? Husbands are to love your wives. And then he says, compare that to how Christ loved the church. Well, what did Christ do for the church?
Died for it.
So he says, husbands, that's how you need to love your wives. You need to love them more than you love yourself, to the point of dying for them. So there's that comparison between these two different things. And that's the type of love that we're supposed to have. All right. Matthew 3:16. I think we'd kind of mentioned this one last week, but it's worth mentioning again. Matthew 3:16. Just go ahead when you get there. Okay.
And Jesus, when he was baptized, went up straightway out of the water, and lo, the heavens were opened unto him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and lighting upon him.
Okay, and I think we did maybe mention this last week or sometime, but there's the idea again. The Spirit of God descended upon him, but the Spirit of God was not a dove, but it descended on him like a dove would descend. And so he's not saying that the Spirit of God is this white bird or anything that you typically see a lot in pictures. Because because the Spirit of God is just that, a spirit. It's not a person with human flesh or an animal. But he says that's what it was like. Like a dove would settle or descend upon someone. That's what the Spirit of God was doing upon Christ. So he uses that that simile to stress what he was doing. Now, with that, there's one that's very similar to a simile called a similitude, and I don't know if that's on your page or not. Sometimes just called an extended simile. In other words, it takes that same idea about comparing two things, but makes it longer. And one is on page, Matthew 7. Matthew chapter 7. It's kind of like a drawn out or a prolonged simile. Matthew 7, beginning in verse 24. Matthew 7, 24. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man. Okay, there's our term liken. He is like a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain descended, floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Now there's where he is contrasting two different people, the wise man and the foolish man, and he's using this idea of someone building a house. Well, the wise person's going to choose a good, solid foundation. The foolish man's just going to build it on something that won't hold up. And he says the wise man built on foundation, and he did that because his faith was an obedient one. Because he says the comparison is, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I consider wise. So it's not just the person who hears them, but does them, that's considered wise. The person who hears them but does not do them is considered foolish. That seems to be stressing the fact that doing things is important. Doing things is necessary to be wise. Not doing them is considered to be foolish. Okay. We'll talk about the other one that's similar to simile, and that's metaphor. And it comes from, at least the Greek word, comes from something that means to carry beyond. To carry beyond. So in other words, it's taking something and taking it beyond what it would normally be used as. So it's taking something normal and common, but extending it, like pushing it further to its limit. All right. This is a good one. Luke 13. This is Jesus talking. Luke 13. And if you get to verses 31 and 32, would someone read that for us? Luke 13, verses 31 and 32.
The same day there came certain of the Pharisees, saying unto him, Get thee out and depart hence, for Herod will kill thee. And he said unto them, Go ye and tell that fox, Behold, I cast down devils, and I do cures today, and tomorrow on the third day I shall be perfected.
Okay, there he is taking the characteristics of a fox, but applying them to a person. So it's kind of taking something that's common and normal and taking it further, extending it, pushing it beyond its normal use. He could have said, go tell that person that's like a fox. It would have been a simile, but not quite as forceful. When you say, go tell that fox, that's a pretty forceful, strong saying. Well, what aspect of a fox, or aspects of a fox, was he stressing? Okay, sneaky, cunning, maybe deceitful, all of those kind of wrapped up into one, all right? They have to be that way. So, he wasn't saying that he was like a fox in lots of different ways, or extremely like a fox, but there were certain things about a fox that was like Herod. And so that's what he says. Another real good one, 1 Corinthians 3:16. 1 Corinthians 3:16. Please read that when you get there. Okay, you are the temple of God. Well, not like a man-made temple where you would go worship, but he uses that idea. Why does he say that you're a temple of God? What aspect of a physical temple building is he stressing that's like followers of Christ? What's he trying to stress there? Okay. Okay. Because he says that the Spirit of God dwells in you, right? He's among you. He's in your midst. Okay. Just like people that for the Jewish people, the temple represented where God dwelled for them, right? It's where He came to meet them. All right. Another really good one. Matthew 26. This is Jesus in the upper room on the night that he's betrayed. Matthew 26. And would someone read 26 through 28? Well, I mean 28 through 20, 26 through 29. Matthew 26, 26 through 29.
Saying to you, I will not drink henceforth of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom.
Okay. Now there's a couple of types of figures of speech in this one. We'll only talk about the one right now. But he says, this is my body. Okay, he's using a metaphor. He could have said, used a simile, this is like my body. All right. But he used the stronger expression, this is my body. Well, if people understood that was a metaphor years ago, they wouldn't have came up with some of the Roman Catholic ideas that these things actually become physically Christ's body and blood. Well, they don't physically become them. But they're a symbol of them. They're like them. And so he uses that expression for both of those. He says the cup, and of course he's talking about the contents, because you're drinking what's in the cup. And we won't get to it tonight when we talk about metonymy later, probably next Wednesday night if we get to it. We'll use that figure of speech as well. He says, what was in the cup is my blood. Well, they really weren't drinking his blood, because he was standing right there in front of them. He had his own blood, and he hadn't given them any of his. So what they were drinking was not literally blood. But it was like blood. In other words, that's what it was going to symbolize. And so every time that they were going to partake of it, he says, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Now, for those people who don't think the kingdom came, then they shouldn't be taking the fruit of the vine. They shouldn't be partaking of it at all if they don't think the kingdom came. But it did come. Acts chapter 2 on Pentecost, not too many weeks after Matthew 26. And he was going to drink it new with them when that started. And of course, that's continuing even until today. So just think about all the controversies about the Lord's Supper that would have been, that wouldn't have been controversies if people would have simply realized that was a metaphor. And I can't imagine why anybody would think it wasn't a metaphor. But nevertheless, we have time for maybe one or two more. John chapter 1, verse 29. This is another one that you'll recognize quite easily. John 1, verse 29. Because we've only got a couple minutes left. It says, the next day John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Well, again, he wasn't a literal lamb. Okay, he didn't turn into a physical lamb in front of John's eyes. But he was like a lamb. How was he like a lamb? And why did John, by inspiration, use a lamb? Why didn't he say, behold, the oxen of God that takes away the sin of the world? Or the camel of God that takes away the sin of the world? What was it about a lamb that was the best way to describe what Jesus was going to do? Okay. Voluntary, meek, all right. Okay. Submissive, whatever we want to call that. And they were used quite often for sacrifice, weren't they? And of course, lots of other places he's called the Lamb as well. So just a few metaphors. Lord willing, we'll talk about extended metaphors, usually called allegories. There's not a lot of them in the Bible, but there's a few, and there's one really, really important one in the book of Galatians that we'll look at, Lord willing, next Wednesday evening. Okay, thank you very much.